officials and the UN facilities since Israel launched strikes on Gaza on October the 7th. All key sanitation services have ceased operating in Gaza, which raises the prospect of an enormous surge of gastrointestinal and infectious diseases among the local populations, including cholera. For Gaza's 2.3 million residents, half of whom are children, finding drinkable water has become close to impossible. The WHO has recorded more than 44,000 cases of diarrhea and 70,000 acute respiratory infections, but real numbers may be significantly higher. Diarrhea increased by 45 times compared with the same period last year, and other diseases from respiratory infections to hygiene issues such as lice have risen. Almost three-quarters of hospitals in Gaza and two-thirds of primary healthcare clinics have shut down because of damage from hostilities or lack of fuel.
No medicines, no vaccination activities, no access to safe water and hygiene, and no food. We saw a very high number of cases of diarrhea among infants. And again, there was no treatment available for them. You know, if you have a child with diarrhea, you need to give them rehydration in order to keep them.
The health needs of the population of Gaza have increased dramatically, but they are now being serviced by one-third of the hospitals and primary care clinics. And with severe overcrowding, the risks are increasing for epidemics of respiratory tract infections, acute watery diarrhea, hepatitis, scabies, lice, and other diseases.
Health facilities in the Gaza Strip have borne the brunt of Israel's brutal war. Officials have described the situation in northern Gaza as catastrophic amid a lack of medicine and fuel.
The situation is very difficult. The patients, the injured and the martyrs are lying on the ground. The medical staff is not enough and there are no treatments. My brother is injured and his condition is very difficult. We wait all day for treatments and medications. There are no medicines and medical equipment.
They say hospital beds are completely full and wounded people are lying on the ground. Experts now warn the humanitarian crisis would deepen fast if Israel started bombing Gaza again because people have been so weakened by almost 2 months of attacks. UN officials have warned that alleviating the crisis requires the urgent entry of additional aid and supplies in a smooth, predictable, and continuous manner to lessen the unbearable suffering of Palestinians in Gaza. Despite the temporary truce agreements between Israel and Hamas, officials in Gaza say no fuel had arrived for generators at hospitals in the territory's north. They say that without fuel, the territory could not pump clean water or clear waste accumulating in the streets, warning of a potential public health catastrophe.
Pursuant to the health status in the northern Gaza Strip, only three hospitals are still operating, but they cannot cover the health requirements inside the Gaza Strip, as these hospitals are small and there are 900,000 people left. In addition, the health situation in the northern Gaza Strip is currently desperate because of the inaccessibility of medical aid and fuel to the hospitals in the north.
United Nations Children's Funds is also working on creating safe places for children, but it needs a longer break in fighting to heal.
Threats to children are very much from the air and now very much on the ground. He was terrified as a medical professional in terms of the disease outbreak that is lurking here and how that will devastate children who are immune systems and lack of food already is making them perilously weak. Again, anecdotally, as a non-medical professional, when I'm in hospitals, it's children with wounds of war and it's children with gastro and who are sick everywhere. And I meet a lot of parents who are medical professionals or at least have master's degrees. They know exactly what their children need. They don't have access.
Meanwhile, UN reports that Israeli bombardments have destroyed or damaged 60% of homes in the besieged territory. It's said in Gaza City and North Gaza specifically, intense bombing has resulted in damage to over 50% of all buildings. The report said the strikes have also caused widespread damage to roads and essential infrastructure, such as power systems and distribution networks, and water supply equipment.
Henry Kissinger, influential American politician and career diplomat, has died at the age of 100. Kissinger served as both National Security Advisor and Secretary of State under President Richard Nixon and continued as Secretary of State under Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford. However, he left a dark legacy ranging from supporting dictators and terror squads to directing coups and ordering war crimes. Kissinger is known for his role in carpet bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War, which caused the death of 150,000 civilians in a neutral country. The indiscriminate bombing campaign was expressed in Kissinger's infamous order to an American general when he said, quote, "anything that flies and anything that moves." The civilian death toll in Cambodia was more than those killed in U.S.-led wars against several West Asian countries over the past two decades. Kissinger's genocidal campaign also enabled the rise of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge dictatorship. Yet, ironically enough, Kissinger was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize for ending a war which he had blood on his hands. Kissinger was also involved in a CIA-hatched coup against Chile's socialist leader, Salvador Allende, in 1973. The coup was followed by a regional campaign of political repression and assassination in South America, dubbed Operation Condor. That resulted in the killing of 50,000 people, as well as disappearance and imprisonment of nearly 500,000 people in several South American countries under U.S. ally dictatorships. Kissinger also supported former West Pakistan dictator Yahya Khan, whose army carried out a massive genocidal campaign against Bengali-speaking people in East Pakistan that led to the 1971 war and finally the creation of Bangladesh. Kissinger's other infamous moves include his support for Indonesian leader Suharto, who invaded East Timor in 1975. Tens of thousands of Timorese people were killed in two decades of occupation initiated by Suharto. Kissinger also presided over a writing of a secret national security memo in 1974 recommending the U.S. government to force depopulation on third world countries to weaken their national power, ensure America's access to their resources, and prevent young population rising against U.S. imperialist control. After leaving government in 1977, Kissinger remained a prominent voice in foreign policy circles for decades. Even into his late 90s, he continued attending global events, consulting business clients, and privately advising American presidents. He has been lauded for his incredibly sharp memory and unique analytic powers, but his bloody record is a testimony that superior human intelligence, combined with inferior moral sensitivities, can be a source of incredible evil rather than good.
The U.S. has played a dubious role when it comes to its stance on the Israeli war in Gaza. On the one hand, the U.S. Secretary of State Blinken is said to want to press Israel to end the war in his upcoming trip to the region. This is while the U.S. President will move to grant Israel unfettered access to U.S. weapons stockpile. The U.S. President has also said eliminating Hamas is very difficult, but not impossible, which is part of the reason why pro-Palestinian protests have continued unabated around the world, since many see the U.S. key in ending the war. Many celebrities have come out in support of Palestine and against U.S. unwavering support for Israel, especially when it comes to military aid. U.S. actress and activist Cynthia Nixon has launched a hunger strike, calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., an unprecedented move by a Hollywood actress.
To have a hunger strike to get attention, but also to say, yes, we are bombing and killing Palestinians in that way, but we're also starving them. 7% of the nutrition that's needed for a population of 2 million people has been allowed into Gaza. And so certainly many people are dying from bombs, but so many people in Gaza are on the hunger, on the precipice of starvation. And so that's why we're having a hunger strike to reflect the horror of that.
She was joined by state legislators and activists also.
I think about how much anxiety and depression and fear and all those emotions that Gazans are feeling every day.
We have lost an entire society. Cities have been flattened. And if President Biden does not demand a permanent ceasefire, all of Gaza could be lost.
only... Israel is so afraid of the backlash, the Israeli lobby has offered $20 million to a candidate of Arab origin to compete with U.S. Senator Rashida Tlaib in the Michigan elections.
I was offered $20 million to withdraw from the senatorial race and run against my friend Rashida Tlaib.
As if that wasn't enough, the Israeli lobby is so worried about U.S. Congress dissent due to the war that it was reported it spent big money trying to purge its critics from the Democratic Party.
The pro-Israel lobby will go to any length to remove anybody from the U.S. Congress that has any opposition to their agenda, and their total unequivocal support for Israel, good, bad, or indifferent.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala Ahli Baytihi at-Tayyibin at-Tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide to managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. Imam Ali alayhi salam, especially in the 31st sermon, which we are currently focusing on, has different sets of guidances and pieces of advice which can be used very actively by those who have some leadership role or some managerial position. And we discussed in the previous sessions about the fact that a person with a leadership role needs to have a very strong, insightful, mindful, and careful heart, a precocious heart. And for this to happen, there are certain preliminaries, one of which is that a person needs to increase their knowledge about the deeper realities of Islam. Another one that we talked about previously was that a person needs to spend some time with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to remember Allah, to increase the light within his heart. Today we'll talk about another point, inshallah, after the break.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. Today we'll discuss another important preliminary to have an insightful, mindful, and careful heart, which is necessary for a manager and a person in leadership, in a leadership position. And that is that a person needs to be careful about the way money is being spent. See, one of the things that causes extreme deviation is the love of this world. And the love of this world is like a very treacherous, you can say, and a very, very sly snake that enters very, very subtly within the heart. It comes slowly, and then it can cause a lot of disruption and destruction. So another a person needs to be very careful from the very beginning. And one of those ways to be careful that the heart doesn't get polluted and contaminated by the love of this world, and of course, you know, by love of this world, we don't mean the positive type of love whereby you use the world for spiritual progress, but rather that kind of love that removes you from remembrance of Allah and from adhering to what Allah wants from you. So in order to control your heart and not allow this love to enter as a leader, as a manager, you need to have your checks and balances right. You need to have your accounts proper. You need to be careful about how the funds that are entering your portfolio are being used. You need to be really careful. Don't overspend. Don't even underspend. Spend where it is required. Expenditure should be based on requirement. This is something that is always, it's a general principle, but especially when it comes to public funds. As an institute, the funds that are coming inside your institute are public, especially if it's not a private institute. A private institute is another thing. But when you talk about public institutes, whereby your service is towards the people, the funds that are coming also are general funds that the people need to see for you, right? So because that is the case, you need to be more careful. You need to be more careful about that. And that is something that you have noticed that Imam Ali alayhi salam was extremely, extremely careful and strict in his lifestyle. And you've heard many stories about that.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are discussing about the importance of taking care of public funds and expenditure as a leader, as a person in managerial positions, because we say that if that is not done, then the heart can be polluted, the person can become forgetful of his purpose. So for that to happen, a person needs to be careful about how they spend. Very clear, and accounts have to be there, and expenditure should be based on requirement and need. You notice that Imam Ali alayhi salam in his lifestyle was not even using a candle even for 2 seconds or 1 second or a moment, just a candle that was belonging to public treasury for personal use. For example, if he was in a place whereby there was a candle that had got, you know, public use, if someone had private work with him, he would turn off the candle. That is the level of care that Imam Ali alayhi salam had. Now look at how much care we have with regards to these public funds. These are the things that we need to be careful about. Oh no, because I'm a leader, I can spend however much I want from this amount, and I have certain privileges for myself. No ways. The privilege is only because of your service. And the privilege, the service itself is a privilege. When you'll meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you'll realize that that opportunity to serve itself was a great privilege. Not that you use this opportunity to serve as a, you can say, as a springboard to achieve your own personal our own personal aims and objectives in life. If a person is careful about the funds that enter in his life and the funds that are used in that institute or in that leadership role that he has, then definitely he will be able to protect his heart and keep it guided, keep it straight in the path that is required towards the purpose of divine aims. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio. قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, istainu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
The compiler Sayyid Razi is a prominent alim of Arabic literature. That is the basis on which he compiled the sayings of Amir al-Mu'minin and the sermons. He also has another book known as Khasa'isul A'imma, where he talks about the qualities of the imams. And remember, he's not that far away from early Ghaybat. You have Sheikh Saduq, Ghaybat al-Sughra, his student Mufid, and his student is Sayyid Razi and his brother Sayyid Murtaza. So they are not that far away from the days of the Imam. And Sayyid Razi, based on his sources, gives the sanad, the chain of narration, going all the way to Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam. So you have some people in between Sayyid Razi and the seventh Imam as the ruwat. And then the seventh Imam continues the chain that I heard from my forefathers going all the way until the early days. And he talks about the last days of Rasulullah. And this is important to know about it. And of course, this is from our source. That the Prophet, at a moment when the family members were there, but Ali was not there. And whenever he would gain consciousness, he would say, Aina Ali. Eventually Ali came. And, you know, he sat down by Rasulullah. Bibi Fatima was there, other family members. And then, according to that narration from the Ahlul Bayt, the Prophet started talking about what will happen after I pass away. He says, remember, they will be busy in whatever they are planning. you will be busy with me as far as, you know, my funeral rites are concerned. But then he says something to Ali at that time, and this is very important. Many people say, why did Ali not take out this sword and go and fight for his Khilafat? The Prophet says, إِنَّمَا مَثَلُكَ فِي الْأُمَّةِ مِسْ مَثَلُ الْكَعْبَةِ. Remember, Ali, your example in the Ummah is the example of the Kaaba. إِنَّمَا تُؤْتَى وَلَا تَأْتِي. The Kaaba doesn't go to people. People come to the Kaaba. And so he's saying that after, you know, I already talked to them, I mentioned about your rights, collectively as well as individually, and all of them said, yes, we believe. But Allah knows the truth. Then he says, you know, when I pass away, you don't need to go then and ask for the Khilafat and your right. It is their duty to come to you. And so already, you know, he says, فَعَلْزِمْ بَيْتَكْ وَاجْمَعِ الْقُرْآنَ لَا تَعْلِيفِهِ. Stay at home. Compile the Quran according to the way it was revealed. And وَعَلَيْكَ, this is the last statement there. He says, وَعَلَيْكَ بِالصَّبْرِ أَلَا مَا يُنزِلُ بِكَ وَبِهَا. And O Ali, I urge you to maintain patience. Sabr on what will happen to you and her until you join me on the day of Qiyamah by the Hawza Kawthar. And so this is where something we have to realize, that the advice of Amir al-Mu'mineen, of Rasulullah to Amir al-Mu'mineen, was to maintain sabr and patience. And this is where many people say, oh, why didn't Ali go himself behind the door? Why did he allow his wife to go? There is another narration connected to this, and this is from Kitab al-Sulaym. I'm using that narration here just to complete this story. That Rasulullah told Ali, you will maintain sabr. If you really want to understand the greatness of Ali, it's not in Badr and Uhud and Khandaq and Khaybar. If you really want to understand the greatness of Amir al-Mu'mineen, it is in this incident after wafat of Rasulullah. When they broke the door, came in. You know, many people ask this question, and I avoided it last night, but I was asked, if you want to know, did Ali show any reaction? Yes, initially he stood up. He stood up and got a hold of the leader of the group who had come. Basically, hold his collar, pull him up, and threw him down on the ground. Ali got on him, started hitting him on his face and on his neck with the intention of killing him. فَذَكَرَ قَوْلَ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ. This is his riwayat. He remembered what Rasulullah had said. You know, he can see what happened to Fatima. This is Ali, most courageous of the Arabs. Yet he immediately remembers what Rasulullah said. And at that time, he says to the leader of the group there, وَالَّذِي كَرَّمَ مُحَمَّدًا بِالنُّبُوَّةِ. By the name of the one who has honored Muhammad with nubuwwah. يَبْنَ السُّحَاقِ لَوْ كَانَ لَا كِتَابَ مِنَ اللَّهِ سَبَقْ. If it was not because of the Ahda Rasulullah, the advice that he had given to me, you would have seen that you would not be able to enter my home. And so when we talk about Amir al-Mu'mineen, then why didn't he react? This is where his hands were tied. For the greater interest of the Ummah and survival of the faith. You know, we normally talk about the Masaib of Fatima al-Zahra, and indeed, she is Ummul Masaib in that way. Amir al-Mu'minin is Mazloom. But in this incident, sometimes we forget the children who are in the house. There is no narration. I don't know where Hassan and Hussein, where were they looking? I don't know Zainab and Umm Kulsoom, where they were looking at the mother on one side or the father on the other hand.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Puriza, with you for some of the biggest talking points coming out of the renewed Israeli genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip and its ongoing incursions in the West Bank. After days of heavy bombardment, the Israeli regime has expanded its attacks in central and southern areas of Gaza. Palestinians continue to flee south in search of safety that just isn't there. Hospitals are buckling under extreme pressure as casualties mount. The UN has described a level of fear and panic not seen before, as Gazans experience one of the worst 24 hours since the beginning of the war nearly 2 months ago. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in overnight Israeli strikes, bringing the death toll since Saturday to more than 800. Hamas says fierce fighting has been taking place near the southern city of Khan Yunis, where Israel claims Hamas fighters are based. Meanwhile, Hamas has denounced the UK for planning to conduct surveillance flights over the Gaza Strip, calling it a partner in Israel's war. More than 15,500 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli shelling, more than 6,600 of them children since October 7th. The death toll from the Hamas surprise attack on Israel remains at 1,200. So what's the Israeli regime's end game in the Gaza Strip? What impact is its genocidal campaign having on the civilian population? How many Palestinian lives does it take for a change in policy on Israel in Western capitals? Joining me for this conversation, London-based mindset life coach and mentor Neil Nasser, and from Birmingham, social justice educator and activist Hassanein Jaffer, joining us via Skype. Thanks to both of you for being with us. Starting with you, Neil, with the bombardment of Gaza having resumed well and truly, was this always the worry that things were going to move in this direction?
I think, you know, taking that pause in terms of the war and that mild ceasefire, then the militia then ramp it up. And the worry is that it's going to intensify and increase the attacks, which, as we can see happening right now, it has increased the numbers as we're reporting. It's been the worst 24 hours since the beginning of the war. Mm-hmm. So that's always been the worry in terms of the plan, if you like, the ultimate plan.
Speaking of the plan, Hassan Ein, Israel's Hayyum newspaper, has carried a story in the past 24 hours or so that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel has asked his closest political confidant, Ron Dermer, to devise a plan that would thin out, quote unquote, the population of Gaza to a bare minimum. Is that what we're seeing unfold, as we have feared and warned all along?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's barely an argument anymore to say that this isn't a colonial exploit. And from the very beginning, I mean, even if you go all the way back in history from 1948, the Zionist plan has always been to displace the people of Palestine and to create a homeland that doesn't include the Palestinians. It has always been a colonial exploit, which is why, you know, unless you have a memory that doesn't last longer than the 7th of October, none of this comes as a surprise to us that their ultimate aim is to get the land that the Palestinians are occupying without any Palestinians on that land. There's no other word for it other than ethnic cleansing. It's genocide.
Ethnic cleansing and genocide. Some would even say ethnic cleansing is some kind of a euphemism for genocide, to avoid the use of the word genocide. The role of the Americans, like mm-hmm. it is believed that the U.S. administration is the only government that Israel might listen to. Do you think, I mean, what is the kind of relationship between the two? And is the Israeli war cabinet even listening to the American administration, or are they doing everything green-lighted by the Americans in the first place?
I think there's that green light there. I think, are they listening to outside influences? Probably not. They have their own agenda, but they have supporters from particular Western countries that are pushing them in this direction. The ultimate goal is to take that land. As we know, there is resources under that land that they're trying to occupy, they're trying to take. They're trying to take control of the Suez Canal so they can occupy that space as well. You know, the agenda goes beyond the political agenda. This is an agenda to wipe out the Palestinians. As we said, this ethnic cleansing, this genocide that's going on, is to basically take those resources so the wealthier can get wealthier.
What do you think of the same thing, Hassan Ein? Who does the solution really lie with? The Americans have drawn the re-displacement of Palestinians. We're seeing it happen as we speak. As a red line, at least publicly. We know the Egyptians' position, for example, in opening the Rafah border crossing. What's going on there? Are they, again, not listening to anybody, continuing with their campaign against the Palestinians, ultimately, as you say, to drive them out into the desert, the Sinai?
I mean, we only have to look at the history of the Western powers and what they have done over the last 200-300 years to recognize that what's happening now works within the system. It works in their favor. The British and Americans run in an imperial manner. So they will support anything that meets their ends, which is the growth of capital, essentially, to be able to have a base in the Middle East and to be able to perpetuate their white supremacist agenda. This has always been the way. I think what Kamala Harris said recently about, you know, there's too much civilian loss of life, and even all the rhetoric we see that says, oh, we need to control civilian casualty numbers, all of this is just that. It's just rhetoric, because ultimately the only reason that America and Britain and all these imperial powers will ever step in and call for a ceasefire is when it matches their agenda. And it will match their agenda when we make it match their agenda, when we make it too expensive, too inconvenient, when the international pressure is enough for them to stop what they're doing. But, I mean, we never have been able to rely on Britain, America, any of these imperial powers to do what's in the best interest of people, and we shouldn't be waiting for them right now.
And that is despite the overwhelming majority, like in the U.S., more than 60% of the people who have been polled mm-hmm. have asked for a permanent ceasefire. In the U.K., two-thirds of the people polled have asked for a ceasefire. Still, all of that and all the mass protests that mm-hmm. we have seen in weeks have fallen on deaf ears in the corridors of power here at Downing Street, as well as in Washington.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I think, as Hassanein just said, it doesn't align with their agenda. You know, the voice of the voiceless is not being heard right now. We are that voice of that voiceless when we're out on the streets and we're marching and we're raising our voices for this ceasefire to take place. It doesn't align with the political agenda. The political agenda for control. Ultimately, they want to have that base in the Middle East mm-hmm. so they can control that particular region. They want the resources that are under that land. They want control of the Suez Canal. They want to eradicate the Palestinians. So, yes, millions of people are marching and protesting, over 60% in that poll in the USA. But what impact is it happening?
And we keep going back to that quote by the now U.S. president when he was a congressman, Senator Joe Biden, who said if there hadn't been an Israel, the U.S. would have to create one.
Exactly.
As if they didn't help create it in the first place. All right, we're going to pause for now to bring in some Iranian government perspective into this. Iran's foreign minister says a deep expansion of war across the region is imaginable as the bombardment of Gaza resumed after a temporary truce. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking from Tehran during a joint briefing with Omani foreign minister Syed Badr Abul Saidi.
Yesterday we heard from resistance leaders that if the current situation continues, the region will enter a new phase through resistance. Deep expansion of war in the region is absolutely imaginable. All parties who are after igniting a war are warned. Before it's too late, stop the killing of women and children, of which a new round has started. We hope that our brothers in Egypt will urgently reopen the Rafah border and stop the Israeli plot against the territorial integrity of Egypt and Jordan.
We heard Neil Nasser, Mr. Amir Abdullahian there, calling for the killing of the children and women to stop. I want you to put your life coach hat on and talk about the sort of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, that the children and the women, the population of Gaza, will be suffering. Those who are lucky enough to stay alive.
Yes, exactly.
In the days, weeks, months, and years ahead of them.
That mass trauma that they're witnessing right now, seeing their loved ones, their family members, their friends being brutally murdered and in this assassination of life, will hold and resonate within them for years to come. This is a memory that they will never get rid of. It's an issue in terms of their mental health and their mental well-being as they grow and go through their lives, something that trauma will have an impact and a stamp on their lives. Mm-hmm. There is ways to deal with that, through professional support and through medical support and attention through professional services, but they don't have access to the basic things like food and water.
Much less that kind of counseling.
Exactly, exactly.
To help them get over or probably deal with their trauma.
Yes.
Hassanein, there must surely be an understanding that Gazans can't just be patched up to be bombed again, to be told to move from one area to another and only to be told to move yet again to someplace else.
I mean, it betrays the hypocrisy of the Israelis, right? Like, initially they came in and they were talking about Hamas, and then where is Hamas? So they asked people to move from the north to the south. They keep moving the line. Essentially now we're at a stage where the numbers for the Nakba in 1948 have been surpassed, both in terms of number of people displaced and number of people killed. Like, we are at a major turning point in history. I think what's really important to recognize here is that we have lived in the last few centuries through colonial exploits, right? We've seen what's happened. You know, we know that America lives on stolen land. We know that colonial exploits have occurred in Africa, in Asia, all over the world. But never have we been in a situation where It is happening right now and being live streamed to us, where we are seeing live the impact of this colonial exploit. Like, it is really a test for each and every one of us to as to how we would respond, how we respond in these situations. But yeah, what Israel is doing is, you know, they are being so blatant in the atrocities, in the way they're carrying out these atrocities, that there is no room for rhetoric. There is no room for conjecture. Like, there is no space for them left to say that this is somehow about safety or self-defense or anything other than a major blatant land grab at the cost of millions of people displaced, thousands of people killed, including very young children. And the cost of it, you know, will, yes, there will be trauma, and there will be intergenerational trauma for years to come.
Like you say, there's no room for rhetoric. But what there is room for, Neil Nasser, and I will come back to you with the same question, Hassanein, as well, is you can fight back through other means, not necessarily violent means, although colonialists and people who waged apartheid against people never left on their own volition, had to be forced out. There is the economic way of doing it. Looking at, for example, at the share price of Starbucks during the past month, BDS have helped bring down apartheid South Africa. Can something like that be or have the same kind of impact on the Israeli regime moving forward? Everybody teamed up.
That's it.
And did the same thing.
I think that's the conclusion. It needs to be a united front. So everybody needs to be boycotting the Israeli front. Everything that support that companies that are supporting the Israeli front, they need to be diminished from your shopping list. You need to restrict yourself from going to these places like Starbucks. We see that share price dropping. If we are united within this, then that voice can be heard in the way that they actually feel it. Because our voices, physical voices, are not being heard, but these people feel it in their pockets more. So if we can hit them hard in that way and come together and boycott all of these companies, and there's many of them, then possibly there'd be a stronger way of moving forward.
From Starbucks to heavy machinery manufacturers. Hassanein, so BDS's strength in its ability to adapt, penetrate, and garner support, it has triggered Israel's greatest fear of a shift in global public opinion regarding its history and legitimacy. So moving forward, again, the same question. What kind of an impact can a movement like BDS have on Israel and its future?
Well, BDS is a really important part of the movement we need to have, but it goes wider than just BDS. We have to remember that this colonial exploit is about capital gain. Like, ultimately, colonialism as a concept came around because of capitalism. And capitalism relies on this hyper-individualism, keeping each of us isolated from each other. Because when we consume like that, we are worth more in terms of our economic value. But actually, what we need to do is come together, like the brother said, and have a united front. Part of that is boycott. But it goes even further than boycott. You know, boycott is a really, really important part of the movement. Protest is a really important part of the movement. You know, appealing to parliamentarians, writing to them, all of that is important. But coming together and recognizing that actually the only reason these systems are able to function, capitalism, white supremacy, the economy and the inequality in the economy, all of it is able to function because we participate in that. And I think we're at the stage where now we have to think about how do we withdraw our participation? How do we, in our very existence, in the way we relate with the world, stop being normal and start thinking about being disruptive and start thinking about how do we make sure that this stops? For now, it's about ceasefire. Yes, we need a ceasefire to happen. And after that, it's about free Palestine. And after that, it's about liberating the world. But we need to think about boycott, yes, but even wider than boycott. We need to think about real disruption.
Exactly. And that should happen at the level of people, the individuals, and, of course, at the level of leadership by countries cutting economic ties or selling fossil fuel or other energies to the Israeli regime or having economic ties, as called for by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. Now, the ongoing plight of the Palestinian remains a global concern, as participants at the United Nations COP28 climate talks filed in for more talks, they found themselves greeted by a rare sight in the United Arab Emirates, a protest. A handful of demonstrators held up a sign calling for a ceasefire in the war on Gaza, some reading a long list of Palestinian names and their ages who had been killed in the Gaza Strip. Criticism of Israel's conduct in the war has peppered much of the summit, from world leaders as well as activists.
Yes, it's a call for a ceasefire in Gaza, because the people who have died, the innocent children, the innocent mothers, the innocent sisters and brothers who have died in Gaza, it's enough. It's time for this war and this bombing to stop. Every opportunity we have, or every arena of the struggle, is one that we must embrace. And the COP is an arena for struggle. And it's a good place to put this kind of injustices going on around the world in the front burner. The war or the bombing in Gaza is not new to Gaza. It has happened in other clans, but sometimes we keep our ears, we close our eyes and we walk away. But it's time for the world to take action. And this is a good opportunity for our world to take action, to call for a ceasefire in Gaza.
Now, in the UK, under Article 10 of the Human Rights Act of 1998, everyone has the right to freedom of expression in the country. However, that freedom is not guaranteed to those supporting Palestine. Earlier, we spoke to Fahima Mota, who was arrested as she left a recent pro-Palestinian procession here in London.
The protest had finished, and we were making our way back towards where our cars were parked. We saw two ladies getting arrested, and what I did was, as you said, something along the lines of, girls, stay strong, free Palestine. And a lady police officer came, and she pushed me. And I said to her, you know, there was no reason for you to push me. I was just talking to them, and I had continued walking. And she said, oh, you need to keep it moving. So I said, can I have your badge number and your name? After that point, we were followed by the police up until we got to Piccadilly Circus. When we got to Piccadilly Circus, we were playing music, Palestine songs, and, you know, we were all just having some snacks because we hadn't eaten since breakfast, so we were really hungry. And we got, I'd say, like about 25, 30 police officers that came. And two of them went straight to my friend, and two of them came straight over to me. And she said to me that there's Section 35 public dispersal order over here, so you need to leave immediately. So I said, I'm not from London, so I don't know my way around here. My friend who you're searching currently, as soon as you're finished with the search, we will leave. And she said, are you refusing to leave? And I said, no, I'm not refusing to leave. I'm just saying right now I can't leave, but I have full intention of leaving. And then she asked me for my name and address and my details. And I said to her, you know, have I committed a crime? Legally, I'm not required to give my details unless I've committed a crime. And that's when she said, are you refusing to give your details? I said, I'll give you my details if you tell me the reason that you need them. And that's when she basically said time of arrest, and she put the handcuffs on. After that, I was arrested. We were taken to a police station. I was booked in.
Despite the treatment meted out to Fahima at the police station, where Islamophobia was apparent, she says she will not be silent.
We live in a country where they speak about freedom of speech, and we have the right to protest. So then why was I arrested? When I wasn't even protesting at that point, I just had my keffiyeh on and I had a Palestine flag. My parents came into the country to give us a better future and because of the British values, but really there's a lot of hypocrisy that we're seeing, that some people are allowed to raise their voice and speak openly about their views and beliefs, but the other side has completely been shut down. And, you know, we were it came to light when the comments were made by the Home, well, the ex-Home Secretary, and the racism that we saw, Islamophobia is on the rise at the moment as well, and racism. And also, like, I wear a hijab, and when I was at the police station, they asked me to take my hijab off for my ID. And I said to them, I've worn this since I was a child. Over my dead body, you're going to ask me to take my hijab off. I will never take it off. And I just sat down on the floor and I said, you know, I've been so cooperative along this whole thing that you've done. You know, I didn't resist my arrest. But asking me to take my hijab off, I feel like that's you being Islamophobic and racist. And I won't take it off, even if you tell me that you're going to book me into a jail, basically. And she went and spoke to the senior and they agreed that they would let me to keep my hijab on. And I think that just proved to me that if you stick to your beliefs and if you stay strong, then Palestine will be free, inshallah, one day.
All right, let's continue the conversation here with my guests in the studio as well as on Skype. Hassanein, has this whole thing made bridging the gap between certain groups harder than ever?
Yeah, I mean, unity is an interesting concept, right? Like, we can't take unity for granted in terms of we all want to be united no matter what. I think unity comes about as a result of us having our hearts together behind the same sort of cause. So when we look at what's happening in Israel, Palestine, we can see now how the Jewish community, for example, has been massively active all over the world in calling for a ceasefire. And these are Jewish brothers and sisters who are standing up and saying, yeah, stop using Judaism as an excuse for your Zionist war crimes. This is the sort of unity that we want to promote, this unity behind a cause and not just unity for the sake of unity. So, yes, we want to get together with people all over the world, but it's difficult, right? Like we talked about earlier and the brother mentioned about Ukraine, when everything happened in Ukraine, obviously we want the best outcome for all humans all over the world. But it was a bit of a shock to us when we have seen Syrian refugees, Iraqi refugees, when we have seen the victims of all these other conflicts on that side of the world be treated completely differently in Western countries. And suddenly when it happened in Ukraine, you know, households opened up their doors to welcome Ukrainian refugees. Yeah. And we all wanted to unite behind that, but it's difficult when you think, well, how come we're all uniting behind this one cause and not another? But what Palestine and what Palestinians are helping us to do is to recognize this for what it is, which is that it is about white supremacy. It is actually because of the color of their skin. And when we can call it that, and when we can recognize that there is, people are treated differently according to the color of their skin, then we can start unpacking why that might be. And it's not just because we humans are inherently flawed.
Yeah.
It's because these systems are in place to allow Israel states like the US and the UK to get away with what they're doing, using dehumanization of their victims to get away with what they're doing. So when we talk about
in
unity,
one, if that's, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're fast running out of time. I want to squeeze in one last question to Neil, and that is the UK's unqualified support for Israel, Hamas denouncing the UK for planning to conduct surveillance flights over the Gaza Strip, calling it a partner in Israel's crimes of complicity.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? You know, it shows the level that they will go to show that support towards Israel, to show support towards the cause. You know, they're partners in one bed, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, whatever they can do to support this cause, to help their agenda to grow even further. And what's their agenda? To eliminate all the Palestinians in Gaza, to, again, take the resources, take the land, take away the Suez Canal and force everybody out of there. We're going to see an increase in the bombings. We're going to see an increase in the terror that's going on out there in the days to come. I'm sure it's not going to end, but we need to have that voice. And we can have that voice again, as I said, not just physically, but through our actions, and have that united front with everybody.
And remind the UK government that it has moral responsibility,
exactly,
because of the Balfour Declaration and
exactly
all the rest of it, to intervene and try and stop it. But we're yet to see that.